Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is human history defined by conflict or by solidarity? Although we have long formed our identities around things like religion, nation, class, gender, race, and civilization, we have also found reasons to connect with those who belong to different groups or discovered similarities and common purpose even among our differences. So why does so much public discourse seem to assume that antagonistic binary conflict is the natural state of human existence? And how have the divisions we focus on evolved over time? Sir David Cannadine is Dodge Professor of History at Princeton University. He explores these questions in his new book, The Undivided Past, Humanity Beyond Our Differences. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much, Chris. You've just summarized the content of my book extremely well.
Well, thank you. I'm very glad to hear that. You know, it is unusual to describe something as a hopeful view of the past, but that's what I kept sort of writing in my notes as I was going through the book.
Well, we're often told by Edward Gibbon and many people since that history is nothing other than the record of the crimes and follies of mankind, humankind, as I suppose we would now say. But it is important to remember that history is also a record of the triumphs of the human spirit. And after all, since humanity is still here, we must have got something right some of the time. So I thought it was worth having a try at seeing what would happen if one pursued those lines of inquiry. I should also add that, unlike perhaps quite a lot of historians, I tend to be an optimist, and so I thought it would be interesting to try to write a book which was perhaps more optimistic about the human condition than some are.
Well, it stands to reason that, of course, we are a lot more than the sum of our worst atrocities, or else, as you say, we wouldn't be here any longer. But why do you think historians have taken such a dim view of our ancestors' abilities to peacefully coexist?
Well, I ought to say that I don't think all historians have, and I go to some length in the book to point out work that historians have done, for instance, on the period of the fall of the Roman Empire, where they suggest that the picture of pagans clashing with Christians or barbarians clashing with civilization, which Gibbon made very famous in his book on the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. Historians, certainly in recent years, have done a lot of work which suggests that, in fact, the relationship between pagans and Christians, or the civilized and the barbarian, were actually a great deal more complicated than these clashing binaries appear to suggest. So I'm certainly not wanting to argue that all historians have assumed that all of human history is about conflict, but certainly some have. Historians writing in a Marxist tradition, for example, think that history is built around the struggle between classes. And I suppose there was a period when that view of both human identity as being primarily concerned with class and of human relations as being primarily, as a result, concerned with conflict, there was a period when that view was very widespread, though never, I think, wholly pervasive among historians. I think it's rather less widespread now for a variety of reasons.
Well, when you talk about something like class, I mean, there are certainly conflicts and we have seen them played out in various ways. But there is also the reality that when there is something larger to unite a society, we have seen people come together on multiple occasions.
Yes, I think that's right. I think that we tend to focus on episodes of conflict, and therefore on the groupings that are in conflict, not entirely, but quite often. Whereas, in fact, it is perfectly possible to write a kind of alternative or parallel history of the way in which we see the world and the way in which the world is, which is about conversations across these allegedly impermeable boundaries of identity. And there's been quite a lot of work done, I think, by philosophers on this issue of conversations across the boundaries of identity, which in some senses I've tried to apply over a broader historical canvas in this book of mine.
So how does our identity play into the sort of us and them dichotomy into which we tend to divide not only history, but in some cases, present day events?
Well, I think that there is a very strong predisposition, certainly in much of the media, though not, I think it's fair to say, on NPR, and among politicians, to take the view that the world is best understood as us versus them, that there's a kind of polarized, binary, Manichaean division. And that sense of humanity as being innately, intrinsically conflicted is very easily put across. And I think that behind that there is then an assumption that we are each possessed of one single overriding identity, which is more important than all others. And it could be religion, it could be nation, it could be class, it could be gender, it could be race, it could be civilization. And at different times, different people have made the claim that that one single identity is the most important, and that out of that identity comes some sense of group identity in one direction and of group conflict in the other. And what I've tried to argue in this book is the assumption that the world is riven like that is, I think, an absurd oversimplification, and the assumption that we can most easily be understood as human beings on the basis of one single simple identity is, again, an absurd oversimplification of the complexity of the human condition and the many different identities that, in fact, all at the same time we often live with.
Yeah, and not only over the course of a lifetime, but over the course of a single day, sometimes it's more important that you are, you know, I would imagine, a scholar or a man or a white man or that sort of thing.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, what have I spent today doing? Well, yes, I've been a scholar for part of today. I've been a husband for part of today. I've been a white man for most of today, but that doesn't, as it were, preclude the other options as well. And it seems to me that part of the joy and pleasure of life is the many and varied identities that simultaneously we have. Identities aren't like hats where you can only wear one of them at a time. Mm. It seems to me, on the contrary, we wear lots of them all the time, and that, depending on which one it is, we may feel some degree of affinity with some people or with other people.
Let's go back to this question of religion. And you mentioned, you know, pagans and early Christians.
Yes.
Talk about some of the shared cultural elements that allowed people with different core beliefs about sort of the metaphysical nature of the world to still find common ground.
Well, I think the whole notion of religion as being perhaps the oldest collective form of human identity, be it the Christian religion or other forms of religion, and that religion is in some senses built around a notion of the saved against the damned, those who are headed for heaven and those who are headed to perdition, that is perhaps the most long-standing binary formulation of the world, that religion is the most important identity, and there are good people who go to heaven, and there are bad people who go to hell. I remember reading the Gospel according to St. Matthew when I was in my elementary school, and being terrified at this picture that this was how life was. And it seems to me that that sense of the Christian religion or other religions as having this very sharp divide between those who are on the right side and those who are on the wrong side has been very powerful. On the other hand, it's of course also the case, if we start with the Christian religion, that the injunction to love thy neighbor, to do unto others as you would have them do unto you, suggests a rather different way of interacting with one's fellow human beings. And it seems to me, if one looks at pagans versus Christians, if one looks at Christianity versus Islam, if one looks at Protestants versus Catholics, then in each of these apparently simplified confrontations between collective identities, there are in fact countless examples of people interacting across these allegedly impermeable boundaries of religious identity, so that relations between pagans and Christians were often much closer than Gibbon's simple antithesis would suggest. The history of relations between Islam and Christianity over the long haul is as much one of interconnection, of cultural borrowing, as it is of war. And the same was even true during the wars of religion between Protestants and Catholics in early modern Europe.
How often across any of these categories of identification that you name in the book do you find that it is particular stakeholders who play the largest role in proliferating the sense of dichotomy, the us versus them?
Well, I think it's certainly true, if one takes religion since that's what we're on at the moment, that certain religious leaders at certain times and certain political leaders with a strong religious agenda have themselves sought to depict the world in this Manichaean way, he that is not with me is against me. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think the reality of life for most ordinary people is kind of coping and getting on, and that often in fact means doing business either literally or metaphorically with people of a different religion, because you understand that in practice that's the way the world works. And part of what this book has been written, I think, to do, what I've tried to do in it, is to enjoin some degree of rhetorical restraint. I think that it's very easy to fall, as I think President George W. Bush did on occasions in the aftermath of 9/11, for these very simplified views of the world as the godly, the righteous on one side, and the heathen, the wicked, the infidel on the other. And I think that that way of presenting the world is rhetorically irresponsible, and most of the time, not all of the time, in fact, substantively incorrect.
Sir David Cannadine is my guest. He is Dodge Professor of History at Princeton University and author of the new book, The Undivided Past, Humanity Beyond Our Differences. We will come back to this conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to be part of it, you can get on the line now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can ask your question via email to think@kera.org. While we are waiting to return to the conversation with Sir David Cannadine, please consider going online to kera.org simply to make a gift of support for public radio in your North Texas community, for a podcast that brings you a fascinating array of guests, of topics, of things to consider that you know is unduplicated elsewhere, particularly on the broadcast dial. You can make your contribution at kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931. Jeff Whittington is here now, the executive producer of this show. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Chris. And I just want to remind everybody that if you are interested in getting your very own copy of Professor David Cannadine's book, The Undivided Past, we will send that to you with our thanks when you join the station with a $10 a month contribution. That's $120 all at once. And because we're in this special bonus day of the membership campaign, a very generous listener who's put up $10,000 in bonus money today, $30 will be carved out of that and put toward your contribution as well, making your contribution about $150. And we'll send you Sir David Cannadine's book, The Undivided Past, with our thanks.
Jeff, as you know, and as probably everyone who listens to the show knows, this is the kind of conversation that I absolutely adore because it takes a different look at something that we think has been settled already. Mm-hmm. It allows us to take current events and see them through the lens of history and vice versa. I think it's a really fascinating kind of discussion to have. It is one that I can pretty much guarantee you will not hear anywhere else on the broadcast spectrum in North Texas except on KERA. I doubt you would find a substantive hour-long discussion of a topic like this with a guest like Sir David Cannadine. The freedom of public radio comes from counting on you, our listeners, for funding and support. We don't have to worry if a car dealership thinks this is too complex to sort of bring people in to buy cars. You know, there's nothing wrong with the commercial radio model, but it does limit the kinds of programming you receive. We are unlimited at KERA except by the extent of your generosity.
And your contribution is what makes it all possible when you call 888-694-6931. Your online contribution makes it possible for you to hear this conversation, to hear Think Monday through Thursday from noon to 2 and again from 9 to 11 p.m. Makes it possible for you to call in and participate in these conversations as well when you call in to ask a question or make a comment to our guests. That's what it's all about. That's why we do the membership campaigns, and that's why we still need to hear from you.
A few years ago, we took the show from just being an on-air property and made it into a podcast so that now we have podcast listeners all over the country, all over the world. If you are a listener just to the podcast, it's worth a subscription to KERA to continue this service being available to you. You can make a one-time gift of any amount, or you can set up a sustaining membership, which is, you know, $10 or $20 or $5 or $50 a month that says, I value this sort of content. I value radio that respects my intelligence, and I want to be part of the formula that makes it possible.
And we're growing our digital footprint here at KERA as well. You can expect to see a number of new digital initiatives from our news team, including from Think, including from some of our coverage initiatives over the next several months and years, certainly, in the field of medical breakthroughs, in the field of education. Well, your contributions help make it all possible for you to get this information however you want to access it. That's what it's all about. That's why we're asking you to call 888-694-6931 or to click and join at kera.org.
Back in 2 minutes with Sir David Cannadine.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Sir David Cannadine, who is Dodge Professor of History at Princeton University and author of The Undivided Past, Humanity Beyond Our Differences. Join this conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Let's talk a little bit, David, about nationalism. You remind us that war between nations can't be inevitable because a sense of national identity is a relatively recent development in human existence.
Yes, that's right. I think that we tend to feel that the world has always been organized on the basis of nations, and that each one is relatively homogenous, and that each one is in some ways probably exceptional, and that each one has a kind of historically affirming narrative. But of course, for most of human history, in fact, people have arranged themselves, well, by choice or not, on the basis of empires more than nations. And nationalism, as we now understand it, especially, I think, what is often termed ethno-linguistic nationalism, is a relatively recent invention of, let us suppose, the last 200 or 250 years. And one of the things that's interesting about the notion of national identity is, firstly, that it's not actually anything like as historically venerable as notions of religious identity. And another is that it often makes claims to the homogeneity of nations, which often in practice aren't so. And it leads us to believe that our national identity is the one that's most important, whereas, again, I think while it's undeniable that our national identity is important, it's only one among several.
Yeah, and it's so interesting today because we see so many parts of the world where political borders are in some ways sort of arbitrarily drawn from the perspective of the people who are occupying those lands.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, if we take, you know, recent news in Iraq, and Iraq was, of course, an artificially created nation, indeed by the British in the aftermath of the First World War, and a variety of lines were drawn on the map of the Middle East, as if this somehow constituted a nation. And yet, as we know, it's much divided between Sunni and Shia, and in fact there is a sense in which a common shared sense of Iraqi national identity is, for entirely good reasons, not very well developed.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now. We have David on the line in Sherman. Hi, David.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I just wanted to say I'm really excited about reading a book, and I think it's a fascinating subject. My question was about gender, and specifically in like the Western civilization, kind of in our modern day. In the last century, the development of feminism and everything, because it was very strong, identity-based kind of politic, now there's more of a, there's kind of a sort of reaction to it, especially the academic elements. People call it the men's rights movement, that kind of thing, but it's also very identity-based. I was wondering if you had an opinion about that, if you thought it was a unique kind of thing in history that's happening in terms of the push and pull between those two groups, because it seems to me, as a student of gender studies, like it's just become kind of a more of a forum for people to just argue about things. They don't really care about issues that are actually affect people as much anymore. So I was just wondering if you think that's a unique thing in history or if that's something that's kind of happened before and just kind of a cycle that we're going through. And I'll take my answer off here. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, clearly, feminism is one of the collective identities that I've tried to look at in this book, along with religion, nation, class, race, and civilization. Clearly, it's an identity that women have. And there have been feminists, Germaine Greer is certainly one, who have argued that the most important identity women have is the identity of being women. Before you are of any race, nationality, religion, party, or family, you are a woman. That's Germaine Greer's claim in The Female Eunuch. Or John Gray, men are from Mars, women are from Venus, which is not quite as sophisticated a view as Germaine Greer's, but it makes, in a sense, the same point. Mm-hmm. But, of course, it's also argued by other people who are working on gender, many of them no doubt feminists, that actually it's much more complicated than that because women are many other things too. Here's Bernice Reagan. Every time you see a woman, you're looking at a human being who is like you in only one respect but may be totally different from you in three or four others. And I think that sense that, as is the case with religion or with nation or with these other identities, the claim that one of these identities is the one that's more important than all others is very difficult to sustain, not least because, as it were, each of them have made that claim. Well, they can't all be right. So while I would certainly want to say that it seems to me that the improvement in women's rights and women's circumstances has undoubtedly in part derived from the organizing of various feminist movements, the fact remains that it is a serious issue of how far all women all around the world do feel a shared sense of identity, and I suspect the answer to that is that it's rarely like that.
Is there a difference in the extent to which identity fuels conflict when differing identities vary in terms of their inherent power? So if there is an oppressed group and an oppressor group, such as particularly in the case of things like gender and race?
Well, I think it clearly is the case that inequality is one of the issues which complicates the whole notion of identities, of identity politics, and the claim of one identity being more important than another. And certainly, if I stay with this topic, the whole issue of inequality is something I would want to talk about more than I have in this book. I think it's also the case, and it's one of the things that I wanted to point out simply by looking in succession at these different and very resonant forms of identity, that of course they aren't quite the same. Religious identities, I suppose, are about faith and belief, or depending on your point of view, superstition, and they're as much about the next world as this. National identities have a kind of geographical salience to them, and after all, we do pay taxes to our national government. Class identities are based on one's relation to the means of production. Gender identities are at least in part anatomically inflected and determined. Racial identities, I suppose, the same. Civilization is different again, so that these identities aren't, as it were, exactly identical. And part of the point of the book was, in a sense, to show that.
We have an email here from Jennifer in Dallas, who is curious about the extent to which works like those of Karl Marx create or perpetuate a paradigm of binary conflict.
Well, of course, Karl Marx and Engels famously in the Communist Manifesto said the history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles. And they were certainly of the view that society was divided into three different classes: landowners, who drew their income from the rents of their great estates, entrepreneurs, business people, who drew their incomes from the profits of their businesses, and laborers, who drew their income from wages on the basis of manual work. And as Marx and Engels saw it, it was those differing relations to the means of production and the conflict over the distribution of these revenue streams which determined people's most important identity, and determined the fact that conflict arose over who got most of the resources. So certainly in the Communist Manifesto there is depicted a world divided between these different identities that are absolutely in conflict. And Marx and Engels drew much of their evidence for that from what they saw as the very fissured class relations in Manchester in Britain during the 1840s. And they took that as being a sign of how the world was going to develop, a world divided between a bourgeoisie and a proletariat. Well, in fact, the world hasn't quite developed in that way. But they certainly set up this picture of a very divided world.
And how does the presence of an outside sort of threat to a nation that is grappling with class conflict affect that class conflict?
Well, I think that nations to some degree, at least some nations at certain periods in their history, have sought to define themselves over and against other nations, so that, as it were, the British for much of the 18th century defined themselves over and against the French. I suppose it's fair to say that the United States for much of the second half of the 20th century defined itself over and against communist Russia. And I think that that's certainly one of the ways in which national identities are very strongly proclaimed and asserted, although the notion that there was a world divided between capitalism and communism, these monolithic blocks in the second half of the 20th century, I think many people said at the time, and it certainly seems clear as it's been retrospectively investigated, that this was an absurdly oversimplified view of what was in fact a much more complicated set of identities and often interconnections.
How does our focus on any one of the conflicts that we've discussed tend to shift over time? And what does that tell you about the validity of assertions that, that this identity is most important or that is?
Well, if we take, for example, the view of the clash of civilizations, that there is something intrinsically adversarial in the relations between the Christian West and, as it were, the Islamic East, which received a great deal of currency in the aftermath of 9/11 and which has been revived to some degree, I think, in the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombings. Then what is depicted there is two religions, two religiously inflected civilizations, utterly at loggerheads, worshipping different gods, maintaining different values, and taking the view that wars of religion between them are rather a good idea. Well, it's certainly true that there is plenty of evidence of conflict between Christianity and Islam. If one goes back across well over 1,000 years and thinks about the Crusades, the Battle of Lepanto, the Battle of Poitiers. But, of course, it's also the case that relations between Christianity and Islam for much of the time have been characterized by trade, by cultural borrowing, by interconnection, and that an account of relations between these two religions or these two civilizations for which these religions are deemed to stand proxy, which simply says it's all about conflict, is an utterly misleading and unnuanced account of a much more complicated relationship.
We're speaking this hour with Sir David Cannadine, Dodge Professor of History at Princeton University and author of the new book, The Undivided Past, Humanity Beyond Our Differences. You can join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Another reminder now that we are raising money for KERA right now to allow us to continue bringing you great conversations like the one we're having right now. You can make your contribution online at kera.org. or over the phone at 1-888-694-6931. When you do, if your interest is really piqued in reading The Undivided Past, we do have it available as an option if you want to take a thank you gift when you make a contribution at or above the level of $10 a month. So just get in touch, let the folks on the phone or the little gremlin in your computer know that you want to do this, and we would be delighted to send you a copy of The Undivided Past. Jeff Whittington is back in studio now. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. And our coach, so to speak, our pledge producer, Jackie Boyer, said, gave me a quote from Vince Lombardi. This is in line with your coach talk earlier.
That's right. We're back to the sports metaphor.
The achievements of an organization are the results of the combined effort of each individual.
Very
so
nice.
That's pretty good. And it
that
really
means you
applies
listening,
today. Yeah.
You're part of that.
Yeah. All of us who've given, and then the people who are just in the door now, Mark Smith and Argyle. Thank you, Mark. Thanks also to Gudrun Rashin in Denton and Keisha Veneziali in Glen Heights, Texas. Thank you so much to each and every one of you who has helped. Has made an effort so that we can combine all of our efforts and end up with really one of the best public radio stations in the country. If you listen to public radio when you travel around the country, if you have moved here from another area, you found KERA. You know how good it is. You can hear it, and that's why so many listeners and people actually support the station from far away, because they found KERA or they moved away and they still keep up with and support their original radio station right here at KERA. You can do your part on the phone at 888-694-6931 or call 888 or go online rather to kera.org.
Public radio is here for everyone. Not everyone listens, but you do. You listen to the station. You value the service. You have come to expect and demand this level of quality journalism, of civil discourse, of news and information, and some little bit of entertainment. You listen to the service. Why would you not make a contribution and be a supporter of the service as well? 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also do this online at kera.org. $265,000 left to go to make up the amount of money we need to get through to our next fundraising campaign, which is months away. We will put this money to work for you in creating new programming, in keeping the programming that you already expect on the air. We just need to hear from you.
888-694-6931. On the web at kera.org. Once the last of these $266,000 remaining dollars is raised. It'll be a long, hot Texas summer before we come back and ask you to support KERA again in the fall. We do this three times a year, and that's what helps keep the station on the air for you. That's what helps pay for the Think Show and for the Takeaway and the Diane Rehm Show and Morning Edition and all the programs that you listen to on KERA. Think about what your world would be like if you didn't have public radio here in North Texas, and then make a call. Call 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org. Make a contribution of just $10 a month, and we'll send you a copy of Sir David Cannadine's new book, The Undivided Past, as our thank you gift. The conversation is great today. You're probably very interested, and this is an easy way for you to pick up the book, of course, which is out and available at your favorite retailer. But we'd love to send it to you with our thanks when you make that contribution.
We know a little bit about you who listen and who make up our audience, and we know that the vast majority of you listening are really the definition of lifelong learner, right? You're people who read even when you don't have to. You seek out multiple sources of news and information even when you don't have to. You are looking always to explore, to expand your mind, to expand your understanding of the world. We know that you consider public radio a key part of this. Think of all the other ways that you fill your mind and the money you spend on that, whether it's buying books or magazine subscriptions or cable, that sort of thing. Public radio is just part of the formula. It doesn't have to be, the majority. We're not asking you to cut. We're not saying, stop watching TV or don't, buy any magazines. We're just saying add KERA into the mix of organizations that you support. A lot of the ones you support with your dollars are for-profit institutions. KERA is a not-for-profit institution that is really designed to serve you. Seems to me it makes perfect sense to put us at the top of your list.
888-694-6931, online at kera.org. We do have this 25% bonus in play. We're down under $4,000 left in that $10,000 pool we started with this morning. So hurry and make your call right now or your online contribution so that you can take advantage of a 25% bonus added to your contribution. A $120 contribution becomes $150. Everybody likes a bonus, right?
Everybody does.
888-694-6931.
You can also go online to kera.org, and at kera.org, if you choose to, you can check out the range of thank you gifts, including Sir David Cannadine's book, The Undivided Past.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Sir David Cannadine, Dodge Professor of History at Princeton University and author of the new book, The Undivided Past, Humanity Beyond Our Differences. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. David, how would you suggest that we learn to put historical conflicts that we know occurred into appropriate historical and social context?
Well, I suppose one of the ways that we might do this is to give more attention to writing the history of peace and the history of stability. Mm. We tend, I think many historians tend to think that the history they want to write about is the history of war. Well, I'm far from denying that that's a certain part of the human condition. On the other hand, as we've talked about earlier this afternoon, it's not the only part. Societies do hold together. They do function, not perfectly, but nevertheless they do function. Peace is, as far as we know, the preference of most human beings and the way in which most human beings seek to live their lives. And many, not all, nations and empires before them achieve a certain degree of stability. So there is an argument to be made for saying that maybe that's where we should start from, that's in some sense is the default mode of human organization and human interaction, and that it's war that's the aberration. And I think if we, as it were, looked at the historical process from the other end of the telescope, from that we often do, I think we might find that we'd have a rather different take on humanity than often we do. It's rather like, I think, for journalists, good news is not news.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for historians, peace and stability are often not seen as particularly exciting subjects. But it may well be that that's what life for most people most of the time is about. So we need to think how we can get a handle on that and write about it and understand it more than I think perhaps we do.
Well, this also parallels the movement in medical science to sort of understand people who remain healthy, who are not susceptible for whatever reason to particular diseases or conditions or deteriorations. We've sort of awakened to the idea that figuring out what's working well is really helpful for everyone else.
I think that's right, and one of the other things that I'm trying to advocate, I couldn't presume to claim I'm exemplifying it in this book, is to urge that historians, and I include myself in this injunction, need to engage more with a lot of the work that's being done in science and medicine these days on the way in which, on what the human condition is, and whether the human condition is one of competition and conflict, or whether in some senses it's more one of cooperation. I mean, I'm particularly struck by the findings of the Human Genome Project, which suggests that there really is no such thing as race, that actually the genes of most people are 99.99% the same. And that provides, I think, what seems to be absolutely unanswerable riposte to those who say that race really does exist and there are lots of different races and then they're divided off from each other and you can actually rank them, which is for a time how some people did think the world could be seen. But I think in retrospect, that seems to be absolutely wrong, and so it's not perhaps coincidence that regimes that were constructed on the basis of such racial identities and taxonomies, the American South, South Africa, for example, Hitler's Germany, didn't in the end survive, partly because these taxonomies were not true and nations and political orders constructed on the basis of them were not sustainable.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with James in Dallas. Hi, James.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
I really enjoy your show, Chris.
Thank you.
My question was, you haven't, I don't believe that you've mentioned language yet as something that defines oneself. And there's a famous Camus quote, I believe, that he said, I don't... have a nation. My nation is the French language. I just wanted to know your thoughts on that.
Well, it's a very good point that, I think, not least because it ties into what has been, I think, in recent decades and perhaps for the last two centuries, among the most virulent forms of conflicting identities, which is ethno-linguistic nationalism. And the attempt to construct nations, we've seen this in the Balkans fairly recently, on the basis of strict ethno-linguistic distinctions. If you speak one language, you belong to one nation. If you speak another language, you belong to another nation. And ethnic cleansing is often in part tied up with that notion that language is a key to identity and indeed to national identity. But the reality, of course, is that most nations in practice aren't like that. If I think of the nation that I was born and grew up in, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, well, in Wales and Scotland, and indeed in Northern Ireland, some people speak very different languages from English. If one takes many other countries, the United States would, of course, be another. Then the notion that there is one single language that everybody shares and that that defines their national identity is in practice not the case. And so it's one of the ways in which claims, for example, to a homogeneous national identity on the basis of some sort of ethno-linguistic purity turn out on closer inspection often to be invalid.
So I think most people are aware of the sort of notion of the clash of civilizations, even if they're not intimately familiar with the book by that title. But can you talk a little bit about the trouble even in defining what civilization is and where one ends and the other begins?
Well, it's certainly been true since the days of Edward Gibbon that the notion of civilization against barbarism, or from the time of Arnold Toynbee on, a different number of civilizations which have often rather fraught relations, has become a very powerful one. But nobody has ever been able to agree on how many civilizations there have been or how many civilizations there are. Nobody has been able to agree on what the criteria are for assessing them. And it seems pretty clear that in practice, The idea that civilizations A, exist, and B, exist on the basis of antagonistic relationships with other civilizations isn't really right. I think that most civilizations, if these things do exist at all, and I'm rather doubtful about that, actually are characterized in their relations with other civilizations, again, in terms of borrowing, interconnection, and interaction. And the assumption that there is some sort of primordial civilization which is perpetually locked in eternal conflict with another primordial civilization seems to me to be an extremely simplistic and rather dangerous way of understanding the world.
So what do you suggest we do with the multiple, often overlapping identities that we all use to define ourselves with regard to allowing them or not allowing them to frame our view of the world and of who is like us and who is not?
Well, on the whole, I'm in favor of us celebrating the fact that we're all people of many and varied identities. And in a curious way, that seems to me to help define the humanity that we all share. And I'm strongly in favor of avoiding assuming that one identity is more important than all others, because I think that's a very unhelpful way of oversimplifying the human condition. And by the same token, I'm equally hostile to the idea of saying that the world is divided very simply between in-groups and out-groups on the basis of one single, simple, monolithic identity. I think all too often it is the predilection of politicians, of public figures, of commentators and pundits to say the world is very simple, whereas it seems to me that on the contrary, many of us ought to be saying, as I've tried to say in this book, no, the world is very complicated, and you ignore those complexities not only at your peril, but probably at ours as well.
Sir David Cannadine is Dodge Professor of History at Princeton University. His new book is The Undivided Past, Humanity Beyond Our Differences. David, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you. The thanks really are all mine. It's been a pleasure and a privilege, and I hope your fundraising is as successful as it certainly ought to be and deserves to be.
Thank you so much. Thanks to all of you as well listening this hour, all of you perhaps listening to the podcast, and particularly we want to say thank you to those of you who are supporting this station with your gifts of financial support. Your gift to KERA is really your gift to your community. It's also a gift to yourself, because we know how much you love public radio, how important you feel it is in this community and in society as a whole. We're proud to be a part of the formula that brings that to you. And Jeff and I, and just about everybody who works here, we're also part of that formula as supporting members of the station. We, we're members just like you are. We make contributions just like you do, because we believe it's important that the service is here. Even if I didn't work here, I would listen to public radio and I would be a supporter of the station. We really appreciate your help at KERA.org and 1-888-694-6931. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. And you know, to carry on that just a little further, even if we didn't work here, someone else would be asking you to support the station. The quality of the program, I mean, yeah, we're thrilled to be part of it here at KERA, but it's not about us. It's really about you. Your contribution at 888-694-6931 is what helps to preserve this source of information, this source of intelligent conversation, this source of respectful analysis of issues, and a place where people can freely and without inhibition air their views, as long as they're polite to each other and treat everybody with respect. That's what it's all about. So this service is really about you. You found something you love here at KERA. And when you make your contribution on the web at kera.org or on the phone at 1-888-694-6931, you're helping preserve that place.
Today is a great day to make your contribution, because we have this 25% match from an anonymous donor to KERA. The beginning of the day, this donor said, okay, I'm gonna put $10,000 in a pool, and I will match every dollar with an additional 25 cents. So every $100 with an additional $25. We started the day with $10,000 in that pool. We're down to $3,747. We would love to get that all spent and beyond. So you can put this into practice by calling right now or going online and making your contribution and having an additional 25% over and above it added to KERA's coffers, which bring you, which pay for the programming that you value. KERA.org or 1-888-694-6931. And if you're interested in reading Sir David Cannadine's book, The Undivided Past, it is available today as a thank you gift.
Yeah, it's a $10 a month thank you gift level. It's $120 all at once. If you make that contribution, the generous listener who has put up this bonus pool will throw in an extra $30 in honor of your contribution. So, you know, you give the station $120, you get public radio from KERA throughout the year for an entire year. You also can choose to receive a copy of this book, and someone's going to make an additional $30 contribution to KERA, all because you decided that it was worth your support, all because you were moved by the conversation and you said, you know what, it's time for me to go ahead and make this contribution. The first time is probably the hardest one for you to do because you haven't done it before and you think, well, other people are going to do it, or I'll do it later, or, you know, I'm just busy right now, or I'm trying to take a nap. but when you make that contribution for the first time, you realize, oh yeah, yeah, they're absolutely right. I am helping make it possible. That interview we're able to broadcast the interview, that conversation, because of my contribution. That's what you're going to say to yourself. And you know what? You can look in the mirror and you can say it every single day. I make KERA possible once you make the call.
1-888-694-6931 is the number. You can also make your contribution at KERA.org. If we have gotten you this far and you are making your contribution, or you're sort of going online and filling everything out, I'm going to ask you one more thing, and this is a biggie. A lot of you work for companies that actually also do matching gifts, and as I recall from having worked at such a company years ago, you just go usually and fill out some paperwork. I bet it's online now, and sometimes there are companies that will also match. So investigate that if you work for like a large corporation, and there's a possibility that even above and beyond everything we're talking about today, your donation can go even farther.
And Chris also likes cookies too. So if you could,
if you want to bake me some cookies, that's fine too.
We're kidding.
No, I'm actually powerless. Please don't bring me any cookies.
I'm totally kidding. I'm just giving Chris a hard time. And you know what? We're hopefully not giving you too hard a time. Although, as the membership campaign stretches from membership week, when everyone's like really excited, it's a week of fundraising. It's a week of fundraising, to membership week and a half. Membership weeks.
We would love to have membership half hour, but so far we haven't been able to make that happen.
Well, and it's just because it takes time. You know, we're not talking to all of you all at the same time. You're busy. We have to remind you a few times. We have to catch you in the right, you know, it's kind of like when you ask mom and dad for an increase to your allowance. You kind of have to catch them at the right time. So hopefully we're catching you at the right time right now. And you're thinking, well, okay, I'll go ahead. I'll pick up the phone. I'll call 888-694-6931. I'll make the contribution. Oh, that wasn't so hard.
It wasn't so hard. And, now I do. I'm part of the formula that makes public radio possible. I'm listening. I'm able to tell what is happening with my money. That's a value right there.
Oh, where did the sandwich come from? I'm just thinking of crazy things that you might be saying to yourself.
You might be saying that to yourself. Or you might be saying, okay, I need to remember the phone number, which is 1-888-694-6931. Jeff is very tired. He got up very early.
It's part of the deal.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You can also make your contribution at KERA.org. There's an array of thank you gifts there. There are all kinds of things you can choose. Lots of you, I'm going to tell you how it works. When you choose a thank you gift, we have to buy that from somewhere. So if you really want a book or whatever, please take the thank you gift.
Yes.
It will make you make your contribution. But just so you know, we're paying for the gift and then we're sending it to you. So lots of you say, I'll buy my own gift and I'll just make a contribution.
Give yourself a gift.
Public radio.
That's right. Give yourself a gift over and above it. You know, go ahead and have that ice cream cone or something.
Go get your toes done.
Give yourself a public radio pedicure as a thanks to yourself for making your contribution.
but make your contribution first.
Right. Don't go.
Don't have the ice cream before you have the broccoli salad.
You've got to make your contribution before you can have the treat.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. $263,000 left to raise. You don't have to give us $263,000.
We'll take it.
We will take it.
Yes.
But you can give us your share of that, and only you know what that share is.
888-694-6931. On the web at kera.org. It only takes a couple of minutes for you to make public radio a reality and to help keep KERA strong. So please take those 2 minutes and do it right now.
Public radio audiences are like none other, and public radio is like no other offering on the broadcast dial. So please support KERA, your public radio station, right now at kera.org or over the phone at 1-888-694-6931. Thank you.